Well, good morning, brethren, and we're pleased to open this day with a service from our brother Tom Riggiorello. And the topic is before you on the screen, the apple of his eye, the apple of his eye, Brother Tom.
Thank you, Brother Brett. Good morning, brethren. I've always been interested in this phrase. I've never had the chance to look it up, but I finally did. And I found that it's in the scriptures a number of times, and it's commonly used in reference to how God looks upon his people. It's a beautiful phrase, meaning that the individual or group that is being called the apple of God's eye is very dear and very special to him, and that he provides special protection for those ones that he feels that way about. And I found it interesting that God would use the eye to show these things about how he feels of his people, because your eye, of course, is very precious and it needs special protection. And I thought we would just look for a moment in how God has provided protection to our natural eyes. You know, the eye has to be exposed to the outside world because of its function to let light into the eye so that we can see what's going on. But it's nicely protected in a number of ways. Of course, you know all this. First, the eyelids cover the eye. And their purpose is to directly cover the eye from any unwanted objects from entering it. And, of course, they also keep the surface of the eye clean. Every time you blink, it wipes the surface of the eye. And you know that God has also programmed into our brains the auto response of blinking anytime you're startled. You know, if I go up to Mark and say, boo, he's going to naturally blink without even thinking about it. Of course, the eyelashes also act as a sort of filter to keep out dust and dirt from our eyes. And here's a very famous set of eyebrows, and these eyebrows act as a sun visor to kind of take the glare out of the sun or bright lights that we might encounter. And then, of course, the eyes are set deeply into the eye sockets and the forehead for better physical protection. Now, I can relate to this one very well because when I was a kid, I got hit by a line drive baseball right in the eye, and I got this beautiful black eye. And I remember thinking, you know, that hardly hurt at all. And I thought it was neat that you get such a neat black eye with hardly any pain. So I kind of wore that black eye as a badge of courage until it finally faded away. And so we see that God has given our delicate eye a very natural protection in the way he's formulated our head. And, of course, our eyesight is one of the most precious and necessary senses that we have. And the fact that they're very fragile makes them even more precious. Now, the first time we read this phrase, the apple of his eye, is found in Deuteronomy 32:10. And the context there in Deuteronomy is talking about the nation of Israel. And it says there, he, that is God, found him in a desert land. And in the waste, howling wilderness, he led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. And Clark has an interesting comment about this verse. He says that the term apple of his eye in Hebrew is the babbit of his eye. This is a remarkable expression. Any person, by looking into the eye of another, will see his own image perfectly expressed, though in extreme miniature, in the pupil. Does our English word babbit or baby come from this? And does not the expression mean that the eye of God is ever on his follower, and that his person is ever impressed on the eye, the notice, the attention, the providence, and the mercy of God? You know, do you have anyone in your life who is the apple of your eye? Well, I do. I have Zach and Leah, who are the apple of my eye. And I can perfectly relate to what this is saying about how God views upon us, because to me, they're very dear. They're very special. I pay special attention to them. They're my little babies in the pupil of my eye. And I look at them differently than I look at others because I want to protect them. I want to encourage them. I want to strengthen them. So literally, it means the baby of his eye. The New American Standard translates it as the pupil of his eye. And McClintock and Strong says, to keep anything as the apple or pupil of the eye is to preserve it with particular care. And then Clark has another comment on this phrase. He says, nothing can exceed the force and delicacy of this expression. As deeply concerned and as carefully attentive as man can be for the safety of his eyesight, so was God for the protection and welfare of this people. How amazing his condescension. The phrase occurs again in Proverbs 7:2. There it says, "Keep my commandments and live, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers, write them upon the table of thine heart. Say unto wisdom, thou art my sister, and call understanding thy kinswoman." Now here's an admonition for Israel to look at the Mosaic law as the apple of their eye. In other words, they should protect it. They should care for it. They should observe it and keep it holy. They should see it as something precious to be preserved. When it says that they should bind it upon their finger, it's kind of like our expression that they should keep it at their fingertips. Keep it at the ready. In other words, practice it and live by it. And then he says, write the law upon the table of your heart. He's saying, have an emotional connection to the law. And I think there's an admonition in there for us as well, to how we see the truth and the standards that we live by in the truth. You know, we do live by certain rules, don't we? And though we're not under the law, the principles of the law are still very valuable to us. And the point is that if we see the principles that govern the new creation as simply rules that we must follow, then we're not going to write them on the table of our hearts. We're not going to protect them as the apple of our eye. We're not going to treasure them and bind them upon our fingers. Brethren, to do it right, we must treasure the principles of the truth and not just obey them. Another occurrence of this phrase, the apple of his eye, is found in Psalm 17:8. And this is a prayer of David. It says there, "Keep me as the apple of the eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings." And our earlier definition of this phrase shows God's special protection. And that's relevant to what David is saying here. He's really asking God to protect him from his enemies. We see that in the following verse. They ask God for protection from the wicked that oppress me, from my deadly enemies who come past me about. And we know that David was a man of war, that he was constantly being attacked by his enemies. So he needed the special protection of God. And you know, brethren, that's one of the wonderful things about David that I thought made him so special, that his whole life he had the wisdom to know that he needed God. Even when he was the all-powerful king of Israel, he had a need, and he always recognized that. And he learned that very early in life. And you look at his youth and you say, well, what was so special about David as a youth? And of course, it was his faith and his courage. And we see both of those qualities when he fought Goliath when he was only around 20 years old. And I'll just touch on that briefly because it's such a well-known story to us. But you remember that when David came to Saul as this young shepherd boy and he volunteered to fight Goliath, this is what Saul said. He said, "Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." And David said unto Saul, "Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing that he hath defiled the armies of the living God." David said, "Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said unto David, "Go, and the Lord be with thee." You know, this is such a well-known story. We usually just teach it to our kids. But sometimes we forget the courage and the strength it took for this young boy to do what he did. And the reason he could do that was because he had previous experiences and that he fully believed that the Lord would help him in every battle of his life. On reprint 1902, Brother Russell says, "Every battle we fight and every victory we win through faith in God develops strength for future conflicts." Without his shepherding experiences, I really doubt that David would have had the courage to fight Goliath. His previous experiences with the lion and with the bear were preparatory experiences for the larger, more important battle to come. And so David went out and slew Goliath because he knew that the Lord would continue to be with him. He was able to equate these previous experiences of God's help and deliverance with God's willingness to help him in this current battle. Brethren, that is a really important element of faith, that faith is built upon faith, that previous experience is necessary for strength for current trials. And I think that's what Paul meant in Romans 1:17, when he said that the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. And so it's a good thing that God has given us the ability to remember all of our experiences, because that memory lays the groundwork for further development of faith. And so here's an example of how the Lord kept David as the apple of his eye. David expressed his confidence in God, and God did his part. Very likely he had an angel there guiding that little stone to hit Goliath right in the right place. And so David did his part, and God took care of the invisible. You know, that's one of the great things about our Heavenly Father, that God is loyal and he's consistent, that he will be faithful to his people and fulfill everything that he's promised to them. And one of the things he's promised is strength in every trial. There's another lesson that we see in the young David. In the early years of his life, we know that he was a shepherd. He was not a soldier. And as a shepherd who worked by himself, he had to take responsibility for the care of his father's sheep. Now, I think back and put myself in the situation of the Israeli army standing there before Goliath, a man who seemed to possess unbeatable strength and who was taunting our army with great intimidation. For me, I think it would be very easy to say, you know, there's got to be someone more qualified than me to go out against him. I'm just a foot soldier. I'm nobody. What can I do against this giant? What chance have I got against this man? Someone else is going to fight that battle. I'm just going to lay low and stay in the background. But, you know, as a shepherd, David didn't have that luxury of letting someone else fight that lion or that bear. He took personal responsibility for the care of his father's sheep. And so there's a lesson in that for all of us. We should be willing to take responsibility for serving the Lord and for caring for the brethren. We should avoid the temptation of saying, you know, there's probably someone more qualified than me to do that particular work. I'm going to lay low and let someone else volunteer. So taking personal responsibility and following through on that responsibility is an act of faith. It's one of the qualities that I believe made the Lord say that David was a man after his own heart. The Lord loves it when someone says, please let me do that. I would be honored to serve in that way. And so, brethren, let's all be like David, the responsible shepherd, and not the timid soldier who wants someone else to do the work. There's another instance when God kept David as the apple of his eye. Of course, it's when the jealousy and hatred of Saul was kindled against him. It's found in 1 Samuel 18. It says, and it came to pass as they came, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played, and said, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands, and what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day forward. And it came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house. And David played with his hand, as at other times. And there was a javelin in Saul's hand, and Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it. And David avoided out of his presence twice. And Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. Now in that passage, when it says that the evil spirit of God came upon Saul, we have to understand that it really was the circumstances that God created that allowed Saul to react with the wrong spirit. You know, it's similar to the time when it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. God obviously didn't interfere with the free will of Pharaoh or of Saul. As with Saul, it was because of the circumstances God created in the 10 plagues that Pharaoh's reaction was to harden his own heart against God and Israel. Well, there's an old proverb that fits here very well. It says that Satan delights to fish in troubled waters. And so Saul's troubled state gave Satan the opportunity to poison his mind. And you think, well, how did God protect David from the poison of Saul's desires? And when we look into it more, we see that he did it really in more than one way. And they came from the most unlikely places, from Saul's own children. Remember in 1 Samuel 19, 11 and 12, it says, "Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, 'If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death.' So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped." And of course, David's wife, Michal, was the daughter of King Saul. But she was deeply in love with David, and being aware of what Saul was planning, she made sure to help him escape. But this wasn't the last time that a child of Saul was going to help David. You remember that in the 20th chapter of 1 Samuel, David now has fled. He's now hiding from Saul in the wilderness, and Saul's son Jonathan comes to him. And here we've studied and looked at this before, but what a friendship, what a model of friendship that David was. In 1 Samuel 18:1, we're told that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And we see in the story that it was through the intervention of Jonathan that the Lord saved David a second time. And of course, most people would look at this and wonder, why in the world should David trust Jonathan? Being the son of the king, Jonathan should have been next in line to the throne of Israel. But he knew that David was really selected by God to be king instead. And so the natural mind would think that they should have been competitors for the throne. Most other people in Jonathan's position would have had jealousy of David. His father certainly was tremendously jealous of David, but in Jonathan we see no jealousy because Jonathan had great integrity of heart. And what he loved about David was David's faith and commitment to serving the Lord. And so that's why their souls could be knit together, because they loved the same things. They loved and were devoted to the Heavenly Father. And when David told Jonathan what was troubling him regarding Saul, Jonathan couldn't believe it. He said, "You know, I'm the son of Saul. If he was planning these things, I would know." Well, finally, Jonathan learned that it was true, that Saul really did intend to kill David. And so he came back and he informed David and he sent him away to be safe. But in the midst of this discussion with David, he does something really extraordinary. In the midst of this discussion of how he's going to hide from Saul, Jonathan makes a covenant with David, and he asks David to swear by it. It's found in 1 Samuel 20, 14 through 16. This is Jonathan speaking to David. He says, "If I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. And when you put this covenant in the context of the setting of David fleeing for his life, you see how really remarkable it is. Here Jonathan gave comfort to David by reminding him that even though the present circumstances look bad for David, someday he would be king. And when he did become king, he asked David to remember him and his family and deal kindly with him. Brethren, here's an example of the best way that we can comfort one another. We want to remind one another that we will not always have seasons of trials. Someday these days of trial are going to end. Someday the promises of God will become a reality, and we will have the unbelievable privilege of sitting with Jesus in his throne and reigning over the earth. And then all the things that we learn in this life will become useful and profitable and a blessing for those that we will reign over. All the skills that we will have learned as shepherds today will be useful and be brought to bear as we shepherd the world of mankind. And of all the people to give these words of comfort to David, it is most remarkable that they should come from the son of Saul. And so Jonathan gives us a wonderful example of how true spiritual friendship should work. It was another way that God was protecting David as the apple of his eye. Here it was through the loyal friendship of Jonathan and the love of his own wife, Michal. One of the experiences of David that stands out, of course, is his sin with Bathsheba. And in that experience, we have to wonder, was David still a man after God's own heart? How could he be after doing such terrible things in that whole context? But you know, as you look at it, you find that the answer is yes, that he was still the man after God's own heart. And it was because of the way he handled God's reproof. You remember the sin of taking Bathsheba and then his attempt to cover it up by having her husband Uriah come home and spend time with her. But Uriah kind of messed up that plan because he wouldn't go unto Bathsheba because he felt a loyalty to his men who were still in battle. And so that led to David's worst sin. He sent Uriah back into the battle and had him put at the front of the battle and then had the troops withdrawn so that Uriah's death would be a certainty. These are some pretty big and premeditated sins on David's part. In 2 Samuel 12, we see how the Lord exposed those sins to David. It says, "Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, 'There were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him.' Then David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing and had no compassion.' Nathan then said to David, 'You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun.' Then David said to Nathan, 'I have sinned against the Lord.' And Nathan said to David, 'The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because of this deed, you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. The child also that is born to you shall surely die.'" And so, in all these sins that David committed, again, you wonder, well, how did the Lord protect him as the apple of his eye? Why was David still a man after God's own heart when he did some evil, terrible things here? And of course, the answer is that God protected him by sending Nathan to him to correct him. He did it by punishing him and by humbling him before all of Israel. He did it by requiring the life of the son that was born to Bathsheba. And he did it because the rest of his life, David was to have a divided household. This constant reminder would keep David's conscience always aware of the nearness of temptation and sin. Remember, his son Absalom's rebellion would highlight to David's mind his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. And you know, brethren, in many ways, death would have been a lot easier for David than what he endured in his life. The experiences with Absalom were going to be some of the most painful of David's life. In spite of a rebellious and ambitious spirit in Absalom, David loved him with all his heart. In many ways, Absalom was the apple of his eye. And when Absalom made a grab for the throne, a great battle ensued between their soldiers. And we're told that David's men slew 20,000 of Absalom's forces. Before the battle, David gave very specific instructions that Absalom was not to be harmed, no matter what happened. And then on a couple of occasions, messengers were sent back to David with news of how the battle was going. And David's first question was, "But Absalom, how is he?" Now, when it became clear that he could not defeat his father, Absalom fled. And as he was fleeing, he rode under an oak tree, and his long hair caught in the branches, and he was left hanging there as his mule rode away. And as he struggled to free himself, he was seen by David's men. And David's general Joab came and killed him, disobeying the direct command of David. And when informed of Absalom's death, David wept bitterly, realizing that even Absalom's rebellion was in part his own fault and was due to his past sins. In 2 Samuel 18:33, we read David's reaction to Absalom's death, and it really is one of the most pathetic and sad verses in the Scriptures. It says, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son." What heartache David endured. What could be more agonizing than the death of a beloved son who had turned against his father? But it wasn't the last time, the last rebellion, that David would see from his children. Even as he laid on his deathbed, his son Adonijah tried to usurp the throne by having himself crowned as king. And so he realized that Adonijah was more concerned about being king than about his own dying father. And you wonder, how could a son be so uncaring and so openly ambitious? And so the consequences of David's sin lasted for the rest of his life. However, because of his humble acceptance of God's punishment and his desire to be reconciled to God and to have his heart cleansed from his sin, he remained very special and very dear to God. Had the Lord not sent Nathan to shake David back into spiritual consciousness, who knows what would have happened to him? And so God once again protected David as the apple of his eye. In this case, God protected David's heart and conscience from being seared and desensitized to sin. God was being a good father to David, meeting out punishment for his own good. There are two more places where this phrase, apple of his eye, appears. The next one is in Lamentations 2:18. It says, "Their hearts cried unto the Lord, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give thyself no rest, let not the apple of thy eye cease." You know, this is taken obviously from the book of Lamentations, and that book is given that name for a reason. Written by the prophet Jeremiah, it is a lament for the desolation of Jerusalem during the Babylonian captivity. This is what one commentator said about Jeremiah and the book that he wrote. He said, "Patriots, you who tell us you burn for your country's welfare, look at the prophecies and history of this extraordinary man. Look at his lamentations. Go through his life and learn what true patriotism means. The man who watched, prayed, and lived for the welfare of his country, who chose to share her adversities, her sorrows, her wants, her afflictions and disgrace, where he might have been a companion of princes, who only ceased to live for his country when he ceased to breathe, that was a patriot." I thought that was a really neat insight into the heart of Jeremiah. A man who loved Israel so much that when it was troubled and distressed, he grieved over it. He yearned for God to bless Israel, and so he tried with all his heart to bring reformation to them. But it didn't happen, at least not for a while. The verse we read is talking about Jerusalem. It's referring to the desolation of the land, the oppression of the people, the emptiness of a place that once worshipped Jehovah. When Jeremiah said that tears run down the walls like rivers day and night, he was expressing grief for the city's destruction. For our phrase in verse 18 where it says, "Let not the apple of thine eye cease," this time the phrase is being used a little differently than what we saw earlier. Here Jeremiah is saying, "Don't let your eyes cease from tears for the destruction and desolation of Jerusalem." The New American Standard says, "Let your eyes have no rest." And so unlike the earlier application of this phrase, this time it's a picture of that it's not a picture of protection and the special care from God's heart. This is a picture of sorrow over the plight of Israel. Remember in Ecclesiastes, Solomon wrote, "To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven." And among the things that he lists there, he said there's a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. Well, here was Israel's time of mourning. And I like the thought that Jeremiah's mourning showed the heart of a true patriot who loved his people so much that it was like a sword piercing his heart when he saw them suffer. The last occurrence of this phrase, apple of the eye, is sort of related to this one. It's found in Zechariah 2:8. It says, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye." Well, now we're at the other end of the captivity of Israel. Yes, Israel, they were punished in the captivity, but the ones who were used to punish Israel had no pure motives that they were being servants of God, that they were doing God's will. Their motives were purely greed and self-glory. And so God said that they would also be punished for the evil that they inflicted on God's people. They touched the apple of his eye, and so they would have to suffer the consequences of doing that. And history bears that out. The nation of Assyria, which decimated the 10 northern tribes of Israel, was destroyed at the hands of the Babylonians. Babylon was who destroyed the temple, who carried the kingdom of Judah away captive, was destroyed in turn by the Medes and Persians. Remember at the first Advent, we noticed that like Jeremiah, Jesus also wept over the troubles that were coming upon Israel. Only at the first Advent, the punishment was going to be far greater than the punishment that Jeremiah was witnessing. We know then that for 1845 years, they were going to be dispersed throughout the world. They would experience a withdrawal of God's favor unparalleled by any other trouble they had ever experienced before. And yet, like Assyria and Babylon before, those who oppressed Israel during the Gospel Age did so in a wicked and perverse way, so that they too are destined for punishment. You know, Benjamin Disraeli said something very interesting as he reflected back on the last 2,000 years of Israel's history. He said, "The Jews are very nervous people. 19 centuries of Christian love have taken a toll." What a condemnation of Christianity. Christian love, as he called it, meted out many unchristian acts on the Jewish people. Just to give you a sense of how badly Jews have been treated, I'm going to show you a list of some of the major times of distress and persecution endured by the Jews. I was amazed at the extent of their conflict, and I'm only showing you the tip of the iceberg. Much of their trouble came because they tried to rebel against the opposing army, often against Rome or whoever was oppressing them at the time. They would try to revolt, and that led to further destruction. So it's a combination of persecution and rebellion. Remember in AD 70, the Roman army destroyed Jerusalem, killing over 1 million Jews, taking about 100,000 into slavery and scattering many from Palestine to other locations in the Roman Empire. In 113 AD, Jews in Cyprus, Cyrene, Egypt, and Mesopotamia revolted against the Roman Empire, and that brought a quick response that caused the death of several hundred thousand. In 132 AD, Bar Kokhba led a 3-year revolt against Rome, and in its reprisal, Rome slaughtered about 500,000 Jews, Thousands were sold into slavery or taken into captivity. The rest were exiled from Israel and scattered throughout the known world. And Judaism was no longer recognized as a legal religion. In 135, direct persecution of Jews began. They were forbidden under penalty of death from practicing circumcision, from reading the Torah, or eating unleavened bread at Passover. A temple dedicated to the Roman god Jupiter was erected on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. In 200 AD, the Roman Emperor Severus forbade religious conversions to Judaism, and then began the persecution of Jews by Christians. In 306, the Church Synod of Elvira banned marriages and community contacts between Christians and Jews. In 315, Constantine passed a law forbidding any to convert to Judaism, and Jews were heavily taxed. In 325, the Council of Nicaea decided to separate the celebration of Easter from the Jewish Passover. And they said, "Henceforth, let us have nothing in common with this odious people. We desire to separate ourselves from the detestable company of the Jews." In 337, Emperor Constantius made a law forbidding marriage of a Jewish man to a Christian woman, punishable by death. In 379 to 395, Emperor Theodosius permitted the destruction of synagogues. In 415, the Bishop of Alexandria, Egypt, expelled the Jews from that city. In 418, Jerome wrote of a synagogue, "If you call it a brothel, a den of vice, the devil's refuge, Satan's fortress, a place to deprave the soul, an abyss of every conceivable disaster, or whatever you will, you are still saying less than it deserves." In 489 to 519, Christian mobs destroyed synagogues in Antioch, Daphne, and Ravenna. In 528, Emperor Justinian passed the Justinian Code. And in addition to giving the Pope supreme religious authority, it prohibited Jews from building synagogues, reading the Bible in Hebrew, assembling in public, celebrating the Passover before Easter, and testifying against Christians in court. In 535, the Synod of Clermont decreed that Jews could not hold public office or have authority over Christians. In 538, the Third and Fourth Councils of Orleans prohibited Jews from appearing in public during the Easter season. And again, marriages between Christian and Jews were prohibited. Christians were prohibited from converting to Judaism. In 561, the Bishop of Uzès expelled Jews from his diocese in France. In 613, very serious persecution began in Spain. Jews were given the options of either leaving Spain or converting to Christianity. Jewish children over 6 years of age were taken from their parents and given a Christian education. In 722, Pope Leo III outlawed Judaism, and Jews were baptized against their will. In 855, Jews were exiled from Italy. In 1078, Pope Gregory VII decreed that Jews could not hold office or be superior to Christians. In 1096, the First Crusade began. And although the prime goal of the Crusades was to liberate Jerusalem from the Muslims, Jews were a second target. As the soldiers passed through Europe on the way to the Holy Land, large numbers of Jews were challenged. "Christ killers, embrace the cross or die." 12,000 Jews in the Rhine Valley alone were killed in the First Crusade. This behavior continued for 8 additional Crusades until the 9th in 1272. In 1099, the Crusades forced all of the Jews of Jerusalem into a central synagogue and set it on fire. Those who tried to escape were forced back into the burning building. In 1121, Jews were exiled from Belgium. In 1180, Philip Augustus, King of France, arbitrarily seized all Jewish property, including lands and houses, and expelled Jews from the country. In 1189, Jews were persecuted in England. The crown claimed all Jewish possessions while most of their houses were burned. In 1215, the Fourth Lateran Council approved canon laws requiring that Jews and Muslims should wear a special dress. They also had to wear a badge in the form of a ring to distinguish them from Christians. This practice later spread to other countries. Oops, one more. In 1227, the Synod of Narbonne required Jews to wear an oval badge. This was reinstalled in the 1930s by Hitler, changing the oval badge to a Star of David. In 1229, the Spanish Inquisition started, and in 1252, Pope Innocent IV authorized the use of torture. In 1290, Jews were exiled from England, and about 16,000 left the country. In 1298, Jews were persecuted in Austria, Bavaria, and parts of Germany. 140 Jewish communities were destroyed. More than 100,000 Jews were killed over a six-month period. In 1306, 100,000 Jews were exiled from France, and they left with only the clothes on their back and food for one day. In 1321, in Guyenne, France, Jews were accused of having incited criminals to poison wells. 5,000 Jews were burned alive at the stake. In 1347, the bubonic plague, also known as the Black Death, had caused some 25 million deaths, and people searched for someone to blame. And, of course, you know who they ended with. They noted that a smaller percentage of Jews than Christians had caught the disease, and this was undoubtedly due to the Jewish sanitary and dietary laws which had been preserved from Old Testament times. But rumors circulated that Satan was protecting the Jews and that they were paying back the devil by poisoning wells used by Christians. The solution was to torture, murder, and burn the Jews. In Bavaria, 12,000 Jews perished. In Germany, over 11,000. In France, 2,000 Jews. And near Tours, France, an immense trench was dug, filled with blazing wood, and in one day, 160 Jews were burned. Brethren, I'm going to stop there. It's probably too much already. This is only up to the 1300s. There are many more acts of anti-Semitism all the way down to our day. We're going to stop. I think you get the point. You wonder, how in the world did Jews survive the gospel age? How did they survive the growth of Christianity? I'd like to cover one more point. Let me just tell you about one more incident that happened some 500 years after these things. In the 1890s, it occurred. And the reason we're going to highlight it is because finally in the 1890s, Israel's double was over. And we see the beginning finally of God's intervening on behalf of Israel. Up to this point, he had withdrawn himself. And so Christians and Gentiles could do whatever they wanted to the Jews. But now God was beginning to intervene. And the incident became a major scandal that sharply divided public opinion in France. It's called the Dreyfus Affair. In 1894, a French captain of Jewish descent by the name of Alfred Dreyfus was falsely convicted of treason by a secret court-martial and sentenced to life imprisonment on a place called Devil's Island. Devil's Island was a penal colony off the northeastern coast of South America. He was allegedly convicted for allegedly passing on French military secrets to the German embassy in Paris. If any of you have seen the old movie Papillon with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman, then you have a sense of the terrible conditions on Devil's Island and the awful solitary confinement that was used so regularly for the prisoners. Before he was sentenced, Dreyfus was subject to the humiliation of being stripped of his rank in public. And the evidence against Dreyfus consisted merely of a torn-up piece of paper found in a German embassy wastebasket. And the paper was later proven to have been written by someone else, a French army major by the name of Esterhazy. However, high-ranking military officials suppressed this new evidence, and Esterhazy was unanimously acquitted after only the second day of his trial in military court. Instead of being exonerated, Dreyfus was further accused on the basis of false documents fabricated by French counterintelligence officers seeking to reconfirm his conviction. A well-known political journalist by the name of Emile Zola did his own investigation into the affair, and he eventually wrote an article in the French newspaper. It ran on the first page of a paper called the Aurora. It's interesting that in English, the name of that paper is The Dawn. Well, the article ran as an open letter to the president of France, and it accused the French government of anti-Semitism. And this and other writings created such a public outcry that Dreyfus was finally returned to France, and after another 2 years in jail, his guilty verdict was finally annulled. But the interesting part about this entire matter is that a journalist by the name of Theodore Herzl had been assigned to report on the original trial and its aftermath. Following the Dreyfus trial in Paris, Herzl witnessed many mass rallies where the chant of those groups were death to the Jews. And he finally came to believe that anti-Semitism in Europe was not going to go away and that the only solution for Jews was to remove themselves from Europe and create their own state. And I think you know the rest of the story. In 1896, he wrote the book The Jewish State, And the subtitle of the book is An Attempt at a Modern Solution of the Jewish Question. And, of course, that book led to the founding of the Zionist movement, which fought for a Jewish homeland, and finally, some 50 years later, the State of Israel was born. The Dreyfus Affair and its effect on Herzl became a turning point for the Jews. Their time of forced servitude was finally over, and the next phase of the plan of God was to take shape. But we all know that anti-Semitism has still persisted. I don't need to elaborate on what was to follow with the Holocaust and the hatred that exists even today against God's chosen people, because Satan is still trying to destroy the earthly seed of Abraham. Israel has been duly punished, and yet the Lord has said that those responsible for these things will have a price to pay. That's what we read in Zechariah, that God would shake his hand against the ones who touched the apple of his eye. When we look back into history, we see a marked increase in the persecution of Jews once papacy came to power. But you know something interesting? We also see a marked increase in the persecution of the saints. And so here is another group that God considers the apple of his eye. We've looked at this before in the history of the church, and we've seen that the persecution of the saints has been so severe that we hear their cry prophetically anticipated in the book of Revelation during the sixth stage of the church. Remember, Revelation 6:10 says, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" You know, papacy is responsible for a lot of sins, a lot of doctrinal errors. But amongst its greatest sins has been the evil devised upon God's people, both Jews and Christians. In this regard, I think there may be a direct reference to this in Revelation, the 18th chapter. Revelation 18, 4 through 6 says, "I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her.'" And there's an interesting point in verse 6. Let me show you the way the Greek is used here. This is taken from a program that many of you probably have called ESORD. And ESORD puts the Strong's numbers next to each of the English word. Now, I'm only going to show you the Strong's numbers for the words that are repeated twice and are relevant to her punishment. From this, you can see which words have the same Strong's numbers. On line 1, "pay her back" is composed of the same Greek word repeated twice. It literally means pay, pay, even as she has paid. And then on line 2, Strong's number 1363 means double. So give back to her double is literally double, double to her double. And then on the fourth line there, Strong's number 1362 means twice. So twice as much is literally twice, twice. So this verse can literally mean a read, pay, pay, even as she has paid. Double, double to her, double, according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice, twice. Notice the emphasis on paying back double, because she has committed double sins. Brethren, there is no injustice that God will not make right. Papacy's double sins of touching God's earthly and his heavenly seed is going to receive double punishment. Remember our text in Zechariah. "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you, for he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye." You know, it's difficult for us to comprehend the inhumanity that has been heaped upon God's people, both Jews and the saints. Our personal experience in our day and age is so different, and yet we are part of the class that God considers the apple of his eye. Brethren, you are the apple of his eye. You are the baby in his eye. You are part of the image reflected in God's eye. He focuses attention on you, his people, and he promises to protect you. No matter what your enemies do, he cherishes you as one very precious to him. And someday glory will come, and every injustice will be made right. Last week we read a verse in Daniel 12 that I thought was appropriate when looking back at the experiences that the brethren have endured during the times of persecution. It says, "Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." And so it has been in the past, and hopefully it will be with each of us, that through the trying experiences of life, we too will be purified and made white and come to fully understand the mind of the Lord. He loves each of us as the apple of his eye, and someday that will be made manifest. But in your faith, you can see that.